You're listening to DraftKings Network.
All right, everybody, Mother's Day is officially around the corner. If mom's gift isn't already on the way, you've got hours, maybe even minutes to get it together. So head over to 1-800-Flowers.com right this second. 1-800-Flowers still has great last-minute deals on handmade bouquets, sweet treats, gourmet food, and one-of-a-kind gifts ordered easily and delivered fresh. You want to get mom something that shows your appreciation for all that she's done? We know you've been a knucklehead. She knows you've been a knucklehead. Please do better. Help your mom feel appreciated this Mother's Day. This is your last chance to lock in these Mother's Day deals. Only good while supplies last. Order today at 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan, D-A-N. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey, please drink responsibly.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the Big Suey, presented by DraftKings.
Why are you listening to this show?
The podcast that seems very similar to the other Dan Le Batard podcast.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that.
In fact, the only difference seems to be this imaging.
I have been tempted in restaurants just walking past tables to grab somebody's fries that if they're just there. That hasn't happened to you guys?
I've done it.
And now, here's the marching man to nowhere, Fat Face, and the habitual liar.
Welcome to Meadowlarkers 46, which is the Herm Edwards episode. I guess I should have paused there to let the listener think about who their favorite 46 was, but I obviously did my research. I figured we're all either current or former ESPNers, so we should toss it out to Herm Edwards for 46.
We should. And last week we went Andy Pettit, and I got all kinds of grief for omitting the great Boston Bruins forward David Krejci. And you know, shout out to 46 on Krejci. You know, so I'm with that as well.
All right. I mean, you down with this? Are you cool?
Sure. Why not?
Amin doesn't have a 46.
I don't have a 46. Is not a common basketball.
Just give it up to Buddy Ryan, though, the greatest defense of all time. Just the 46.
You know, before we get into our topic, actually, we were just chatting before we hit record, and I learned, Amin, that you function on 4 hours of sleep a night, and I need to understand.
It's not on purpose. I don't sleep more than 4 or 4.5 hours a night, and I wish I could say, I get up and I'm all tired. But I'm not. I don't feel ill effects during the day, and things just move on, and then I keep going, and I go to sleep, and I wake up again, and that's just kind of my rhythm at this point. There was a point where I was concerned. I was like, man, this can't be good for you, but like I literally feel no ill effects, so I guess not.
Okay. I mean, Howard, I'm 8.5 hours a night. Oof. I would say over the last 10 years, I have averaged 8.5 hours a night of sleep. I will gobble sleep anywhere sleep presents itself. Where are you on this spectrum?
I am very, very similar. And I also write at night. So, you know, when I work on my books, I go to bed at 4 or 5 in the morning, which is why anyone who calls me at 10 o'clock is like, you know what you're going to get. Also, I am a world-class napper. So the pandemic has been great for being in the house and just I'm good 25 minutes and then I'm up again. So okay. I am closer to you. I cannot function on just 4 hours, man.
All right. Well, I mean, speaking of world-class, you're a world-class napper. To introduce our topic today, there was a lot of world-class artists and rock and roll bands and all kinds of acts that were teed up for the topic of this week, Meadowlarkers 46. And that was at Woodstock 99. Now I am the motivator behind doing this topic here today. I watched specifically the doc on Netflix, Woodstock 99. three-part doc. There's also a doc about Woodstock 99 on HBO. But we're specifically, we watched the one on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of different threads that I want to talk about, whether it's like sports and crowd control, how the late 90s does or does not illuminate our current state of affairs, and other avenues. But just to start, what did you all think of it as like, Amin, I'll go to you first, because I heard you have a podcast, Cinephobe, that deconstructs movies. So I feel like you're a bit of an expert. What did you think of the doc?
Well, first of all, it was just a wonderful time capsule, because as I'm watching these old gray faces on the television screen saying, I was at Woodstock 99, and I'm like, wow, yeah. Well, what? Tell us, old timer, what was it like? It's like, well, I was 19 at the time. I was like, holy shit, I'm older than you are? Yeah. This is my generation. These people that were at, I was in college. This was the target demographic. And I remember it happening. I remember the complaints on day one were about the price gouging. I remember about the soulless corporate nature and how it was so different from what the original Woodstock was about and what it was like. And then I remember the chaos afterwards. It just, I don't know, somehow in the fog of time, it became something that happened to older people as opposed to, no, these were people who were exactly my age. And it's the lack of control that was happening there. It was both shocking, and then it immediately made me think of every event I go to now, whether it's sporting events or concerts or whatever, and say, is it really that different? Thought about the NBA playoffs, where we kept having protesters glue themselves to the floor and chain themselves to the stanchion. And I'm like, well, that happens because really in a room full of 20,000 people, how can you ever stop someone from getting so far? Maybe not doing ultimately what they wanted to do, but getting close enough. And it very thought-provoking for sure for me. I don't know, Howard, you're slightly older than I am. So I don't know from your perspective what you remember of it from the time and what this evoked inside you watching this documentary.
I actually thought it was all kind of fascinating for a couple of reasons. One, I never even knew it existed. I was like, okay, what, 99? I was 30. And I was on the beat my second year covering baseball. I'm not a concert person anyway. I hate people and crowds and shit. And it's not my thing, right? I mean, it really isn't. I don't go to concerts. And the only reason I cover sporting events is because there's a press box. I mean, I don't like being around that many people. So looking at the doc and remembering the doc, it hit me. There were a couple of things that hit me because I saw the HBO doc first last year. And I thought this one was better. And I thought that the first thing that hit me was this, it was clearly a seminal moment for a lot of people. And it went right past me. Like, it's not my moment. You know what I mean? It's certainly not one of those things where I can like point to what was happening. In watching it, I was like, oh, I kind of remember this now. I remember people talking about this thing sort of being a train wreck. And so, but I mean, I'm not sure that that's what I took from it. I mean, I think certainly there's an element to that where you look and you say, okay, when you have an event of this scale, why don't more things go wild, right? Why? Mm-hmm. It's sort of a testament to the traditions and culture and civility that you don't have people go as crazy as they can go. What I took from the doc really was two things. The first thing was the abject cynicism of the time. This is a money-making venture. This is the first template of this whole thing. We are here to make a ton of money. And the second thing that I took from it was absolutely the mood. I think whenever you do a documentary, whenever you're trying to tell a story, whether you're writing a book, whether you're doing a story or doing a doc, you are looking for moments. And Kate, I'll throw this over to you. You're looking for moments that transcend culture. Sometimes you pull it off, and you go, yeah, this was a seminal moment that really did reflect the times, and now we can look back at this. And there are other times when people throw names and dates and whatnot out there, and it doesn't really represent the culture. It doesn't really say a whole lot. There just happened to be, oh, that in 1957, a loaf of bread was 75 cents. Okay, so what? What about that? And so for this one, I thought that it did succeed in tapping into a certain type of musical anger that ran completely counter to the idea of Woodstock. And also, let's not completely romanticize Woodstock, which was 3 days of a mess. If you go, you know, depending on the type of Woodstock literature you read from 69, that place was a disaster as well, because it rained for a couple days up there and everything else. So the thing that I really took from it was this reflective of one of those historical intersections.
You know, real quick, Kate, you mentioned the music that went counter to what Woodstock was about, but that musical rage ran concurrent with what people were feeling, which was that capitalism sucking the soul of art and everything around it. It's funny, I like karaoke. I go out to karaoke spots all the time. And
in lieu of sleep,
in lieu of sleep,
or sleeping, I'm at the karaoke bar,
or at weddings, you know, when the reception or whatever, and when Backstreet Boys, I Want It That Way comes on, everyone sings it wholeheartedly, unironically, they love it, and this reminded me there was a time when they're like, Backstreet Boys, boo, oh, get that plastic shit off them, and it's funny how we've. In a weird way, we've transformed back into very accepting of capitalism and of commercial success and of pop and popularity and things like that. At a time in 99, that wasn't what we felt at all. We felt like everything radio or everything on TV was just kind of the bullshit.
Yeah.
Kind of superficial stuff.
Yeah, and I tend to think the exact opposite in a lot of ways. I think this is actually a really good conversation, Kate, and just go. I'll come play on after you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, it's hard because I'm like, this Woodstock 99 was my generation to a T. I don't know what percentage of people were high school seniors that went there, but probably a pretty high percentage. I was a high school senior. I graduated high school in 99. Woodstock 99 wasn't my scene though, because I wasn't a basketball player. I did AAU. Like there was no chance, even though I grew up in upstate New York, this happened 90 minutes from my house. I was never going to be going to Woodstock 99.
Right.
Like it just wasn't who I was in high school. But it was watching this doc was a window into insight that I didn't have at the time that has started to reveal itself. And that by that, I mean, like I grew up, as the doc mentioned, they only mentioned American Pie. But like a bunch of films that I loved, one in particular, like Miss Congeniality, for example.
Yeah.
Thought it was amazing, thought it was funny. Not surprising when you rewatch it, why I had a lot of like misogyny that I myself exhibited. Like, because all of the things of that period, and then you look at Woodstock 99 and the behavior, and you're like, oh, that explains why up until 2008, if the Giants didn't play well, or if I wanted to disparage the Cowboys, I'd call them the Cowgirls. Like things I was saying up until like 10 years ago, like seeing my upbringing and my high school cohorts reflected back at me did not surprise me why I had behavior patterns that I did. But Amin, you bring up like a little, I have some disconnect between believing the late 90s was us rejecting the NSYNCs, the Backstreet Boys, because that was maybe one crowd that was happening.
Yeah.
But it certainly wasn't my experience of the late 90s as someone who got the Backstreet Boys CD for a graduation gift.
So I'll give you a great example. Do you remember what Sprite's campaign was during the 90s?
No.
Image is nothing, thirst is everything, obey your thirst. Every commercial Sprite had poked fun at the idea, and which is meta, right? Which is a corporate entity selling us that corporate entities are bad and just obey your thirst. That's all it's about, right? But it was a brilliant marketing campaign because it captured the angst of the youth at the time, which was to hell with all these corporate shills and endorsers trying to sell us things that aren't true. We're not about that. It's all about keeping it real. Had its heyday right then in the late 90s. The idea that everything, you had to keep it real. And what those boy bands, what corporate sponsorship, what all those things represented was everything that we felt was inauthentic and therefore bad. What made Allen Iverson such a cult hero was he was the anti-Jordan. Jordan was the company man. Drink Gatorade, wear Hanes, you know, represent the
league. And your $1,200 suit to a basketball game.
Right. And Allen Iverson was, no, to hell with all this, and I don't care if I don't have any endorsements, and I'm going to dress the way I dress and have my hair the way I do. And that was like such a strong, strong resonation with people of my, I guess, my age.
And then the
group.
Corporations took care of that. They're like, we can profit off of the anti-establishment mm-hmm. as well. And I look at it this way, because like I said, I was 30 in 1999. And you know, I was grown up. And so I was a professional traveler and covering baseball and, you know, doing something totally different. But I was also living in California as a 30-year-old. And living in San Francisco, you're in the middle of the dot-com boom and bust.
Yeah.
And if there's nothing anti-capitalist about that. We were living in a time during that period where, which is happening now in the pandemic. Wait, where,
is it,
you know,
similar?
Very.
It was a similar vibe as to now of like the dot-com.
Well, the pandemic, what you've seen in the pandemic is a bunch of people, rich people making their move. Mm-hmm. It's like people are suffering. This is a great buying opportunity. And you see, look at what's happening in real estate. Look at what's happening in real estate around the country. Look at New York. Look at all these other places where people are coming in. When I was in San Francisco during that time period, you would go look at an apartment and rent was like $1,200 a month, right? Or $1,500 a month. And some dot-commer would come in and say, I'll give you $4,000 if you take it off the market. That type of shit, right? I mean, this is the type of stuff that's happening now, because now that people don't have to be in their offices anymore, New York and California money goes a long way in Massachusetts and goes a long way in New Mexico and goes a long way in Taos and Portland and every other place. And so all of this sort of counterculture, anti-establishment, that, you know, attitudes that may have been taking place for kids who were younger, you know, in your early 20s or in your teens, that wasn't the case as when, you know, at my age. And so, but you could also feel it in the music. I mean, obviously, you know, the 90s grunge is that whole type of, there is a sentiment there. And then of course, also the other thing that I thought was really interesting about the way the doc was sort of framing, you know, was sort of framing where we were at, was, you know, the Clinton Lewinsky stuff as well, about sort of what did we believe as people, and how much were we believing in this machine, and it's interesting that this was taking place 18 months from 9/11. This was like the last, you know, things. Right. When you look at this documentary, you're looking at that little slice in time, and it really is in some ways a bookend. It's like the last chapter before the 2000 election, before things just go way in another direction. But I thought that for me, what I really took, I took two things really from it mostly. You know, one was just the comparison to Woodstock in general. These are different people, different generation, different attitudes. And watching it, you could just sort of feel how inauthentic it all felt. And then the other piece of it too, looking at it from a 2022 lens, is absolutely that sort of, I wouldn't say the last stand of misogyny, obviously, but certainly this is the culture. Like when people say, oh, well, he's a product of his times, and people will say, oh, well, I don't understand how in the 1940s, the 1950s, we just accepted things. Well, look at what we were accepting then in the 90s.
That's the part where I think I'm going to push back a little bit in terms of, I don't think it was accepted, right? It happened. I don't think it was.
It was very much accepted.
I mean, I didn't even, some of the things that.
The groping, like the outright sexual assault that was happening. I don't think any of that was accepted. It happened. And I'm not saying it was rare. It was commonplace, but I don't think it was accepted. It was a crazy event where I don't think the rules that or what happened there is indicative of what life was like in 1999, where you could just walk up to people and molest them without any sort of repercussion or anything. It's more about kind of like the catcalling, the jeering, the intense bro-y behavior and all that stuff. That's the stuff that I think was, that's very much of the time, and that was accepted and normalized.
But that's what comes with it.
Yeah.
These two things go hand in hand.
Yeah, and it seemed like it was surprising to me, now living in the world I do and trying to process these things differently. I don't think 19-year-old me would have even known to have had a problem with some of these things. Like, it was interesting for me to watch Sheryl Crow perform mm-hmm. in the doc.
Yeah.
And then, you know, people catcalling and like, show us your tits
repeatedly.
And I imagined myself in 1999 probably thinking what a lot of the 19-year-olds there would have been thinking, which is, what's the big deal? What, like, not understanding the progression of how this behavior manifests and being so indoctrinated into it. Whereas, like, now if I went to a show and somebody was yelling that out, I would immediately, like, I would think differently about how I wanted to react to it. And I think I also, like, I don't know if I'm making too big of a leap, but I wanted to know what you guys thought. I'm watching the endless amounts of footage, and I could have done with less footage of, like, mostly white bro-y dudes raging at the camera, which it was a lot of it, and most of it was necessary. And then it got to the point of, like, gratuitous. I get it. But every time I saw it, all I could think was, like, am I surprised that the Duke lacrosse scandal happens 5 years later? Like, am I surprised at how some of the things, like, in our sports world then take place? And I'm not, and the connection I'm making here is only like, oh, here is a culture that is in its, not dying gasps, because as Howard said, it's not like it's gone. But then we have this, like, Duke lacrosse scandal where we're trying to overcorrect for this behavior that we've seen. I couldn't help but get those two out of my mind.
Yeah, I think, Kate, when you're watching this, especially, I mean, for me watching it, you can see, it reminded me of the 1950s, right, in some ways, that if you follow the history of the 1950s and, you know, the man in the gray flannel suit and this very, very stiff post-war decade of prosperity, where now you've got the GI Bill and everybody can go buy a house, and it's a very, very antiseptic, it's considered to be a very antiseptic decade, a very repressed decade, anti-communism, all of these different things where you were supposed to conform. Eventually that's gonna explode, and then it explodes into the 1960s. And so you watch this and you see this bro culture, and when I was watching it, what I felt more than anything else was, this is another example of who gets to tell your stories, right? The person behind the camera was probably the person in front of the camera as well. They weren't that different, which is why you gravitated toward those images. What gets shown, what gets emphasized. And so seeing this and seeing the whole body surfing and the mosh pit and the whole thing and, you know, the groping on the bodies and all of that, eventually at some point, there was going to be an explosion in the other direction where women were going to say, enough of this shit, right? It took 20 more years, but eventually it was heading in this direction. How long can you, how long can you have an American Pie society, right? Before the people who are the objects of this are like, enough. And so watching it, the first thing I looked at was, all right, how many black people are actually at this thing? I'm like, exactly. I saw Wycliffe doing his Jimi Hendrix thing, and you saw one or two smattering of black people there. And it, you know, to be honest, in watching it, I was like, this is why I avoid crowds. This is why, I mean, this thing is a tinderbox. And growing up, you know, where I grew up, you know, being black in those crowds, I was like, okay, as the alcohol starts flowing, the racial slurs are soon to follow, mm-hmm. and I'm getting the fuck out of here, right? I mean, this was exactly, watching that, I'm like, yeah, this thing has the potential to go completely sideways. In addition to me never using a porta potty as well, like, no, it's just not my scene, right? I mean, just that whole thing was just not my scene, but it was also looking at that, and you know that whenever you get people in a group, people are waiting for something to go wild, so they all have license to just lose it, right? They all, everyone, I mean, it's like the Malice at the Palace or something. Everyone's waiting for one thing to push it so we can all just lose it. And, you know, you start adding drugs and adding the alcohol and adding all that stuff and adding being teenagers in there. Like, what was the other girl in there saying? I was 14. What are you doing that? You're a 14-year-old in that? And you add 250,000 people to this?
And I guess that's the part that, for me, reverts back to, man, we have an illusion of control whenever we go to any one of these events. We have an illusion of order and structure. Because if, you know, the Malice is a great example. If shit wants to go sideways, man, it's going to go sideways and there's nothing you can do about it. I think about this all the time when I'm driving on the freeway. I always have this thought as a, this whole thing works because we're all assuming everyone here just wants to get from point A to point B, driving at 70 miles an hour in this straight line. All it takes is one person to say, you know what, the hell with it. 90-degree turn in the middle of traffic, and you have massive, massive destruction.
And you have chaos.
And yeah. Chaos and casualties, right? And so I'm watching this thing, and I'm like, I don't care how much security you could have had there. This thing was a powder keg, and it was going to explode, and there was...
But we're always looking for the powder keg, and you know what I mean? Let me throw this thing out at you, too. I was thinking about this, watching this. Is, can we just talk a little bit about these organizers?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Right? I mean, I know they like to blame Limp Bizkit for the whole thing, but this is on you, fellas. Y'all did this on purpose in a lot of ways because you...
Soulless corporation. Trying to make money.
It's sold. I mean, exactly. I mean, in the very first thing is they wouldn't let us bring water in here.
Like the Lisa Law, who's the photographer, who was also at Woodstock 69, she talked about it. She talked about all the little things that, you know, these people are already coming in, as we've already established, with a lot of angst because of the time and because of what they perceive to be the, you know, the solidification of music and all that stuff. All right, they're walking in there. Now you look at all the little things. You're not allowed to bring water in there. You can buy water here. You can buy food. Oh, by the way, we're going to price gouge you. And also, there will be no sanitation. We're just going to have crap everywhere, right?
And no shade.
And no shade.
It's going to be on asphalt? In an army base?
Tarmac. This is the worst kind of asphalt. It's made to withstand planes taking off and landing all day long, every day. So all of these things are combining to give you ultimately the shittiest form of experience you can have while listening to your favorite music. Oh, by the way, the actual book are all going to be the most... Hey, you, and it gets no better than booking an act called Rage Against the Machine. What, pray tell, did you think the machine was?
To be fair to Rage Against the Machine, and I learned after watching this doc, there's a huge difference between Limp Bizkit and Rage Against the Machine, sure. I have learned.
Sure, absolutely.
In that, at least Rage Against the Machine is attempting to say eloquent things about important societal issues versus like Limp Bizkit just being like
angry, you
know, angry young man, doesn't matter what the reason is.
Rage Against the Machine is the intellectual pushback towards things very specific happening in society. And Limp Bizkit was, I'm f-ing mad.
Right, but I think this crowd was more Limp Bizkit than Rage Against the Machine.
And don't forget Korn.
And Korn. But I think this crowd was whatever the music was going to lead them to. Because when Bush came on after Korn, they brought it back to like, hey, man, we're all here. We all love each other. Let's have a good time. I think if the organizers had a lineup of people, where at least you broke it up a little bit.
But the organizers, I mean, admitted they didn't even know the bands. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They didn't even know what they were bringing in to this event. Exactly. It's like going, okay, we've got a lot of dynamite.
What does dynamite do?
What does it actually do? It's the Looney Tunes line. Like, what is this dynamite? Like,
exactly.
All right, everybody, Mother's Day is officially around the corner. If mom's gift isn't already on the way, you've got hours, maybe even minutes, to get it together. So head over to 1-800-Flowers.com right this second. 1-800-Flowers still has great last-minute deals on handmade bouquets, sweet treats, gourmet food, and one-of-a-kind gifts ordered easily and delivered fresh. You want to get mom something that shows your appreciation for all that she's done? We know you've been a knucklehead. She knows you've been a knucklehead. Please do better. Help your mom feel appreciated this Mother's Day. This is your last chance to lock in these Mother's Day deals. Only good while supplies last. Order today at 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan, D-A-N. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan.
Hey, listeners, it's Mike Ryan, and I've changed a lot over the course of 20 years that you've known me. I've gone from unlikable to, well, my hair has changed. But my point is, while a lot's changed over our relationship, there's one thing that hasn't changed one bit. And that's a great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So what's the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite has sparked this debate way back in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. They keep it simple. It's got undebatable quality, great taste, 96 calories, you know all those things. It's a beer that strips everything away that you don't need and holds on to what matters most. But with Miller Lite, you don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. It's both those things. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
But here's the other thing, too, and I do think it's important, like I said, when you're telling stories, like if you're looking at it from a storytelling journalistic perspective, do you have moments that do reflect your culture, right? So can you take this moment and say, here's why this was important? Right. And then to have your viewers go, yeah, that's exactly right. Or do you have these superficial moments that you're going to try to make be representative of a culture that really didn't represent the culture? And I think that when you think about Woodstock 69, you have a very, very, very specific, very specific cultural moment. You've got civil rights happening and you've got Vietnam happening. Mm-hmm. You've got these two things that really made you feel like American society was coming apart, right? This country has exploded. That is the template for Woodstock. That's what people are walking into. No wonder they want peace. This is why they want peace. This is why you want love through the music. You're looking for an oasis. 1999, the message is being sold is money.
Yeah.
You have an all-volunteer army, an all-volunteer military. Nobody's fought it, supposedly, if you read the great David Halberstam's book, War in a Time of Peace, all about the Balkans. It's essentially that Americans, and it would be absolutely exacerbated by the time you get to 9/11, thank you for your service. In other words, they do the fighting, we do the living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so the people who are going to this event are not going to the event with the same cultural attitude in mind. I mean, you're going there with anger, and there is rage, and the messages being sent in 1999 are not messages of community.
Mm-hmm. And this, Howard, this is one reason why I found the doc illuminating. Is to your point, 99 had no legitimate reason for happening in 99 the way 69
except it was an anniversary. That's it, it's a 30th anniversary.
Except that, and then what they try to do is they try to shoehorn in Columbine had just happened. Mm-hmm. And so we think kids are going to be about guns and gun rights and gun laws and, you know, mass casualty events. Like, we are going to tell them that this is what matters right now in 99, which, as someone who, again, was a high school senior, remember watching Columbine, don't remember thinking as a 19-year-old, my belief system is affected in this way. It was just pure processing, the way I remember it as a high school.
No, like, I remember, exactly. I remember watching Columbine. I was in Cleveland.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so the point I'm making is, like, so when you pull back, what is actually happening at Woodstock 99 is the organizers have decided that in order to put an altruistic sheen on this event,
we're gonna
they're
pick
going
a moment.
To pretend that this is about Columbine and gun rights, which to me is, again, we had like 9/11 happens after this, and the Queen, you know, Amin's talking about Sprite and, you know, image is nothing, thirst is everything. We have the dot-com bust, but then we've built it back up through social media. It's not the corporate, I mean, corporations still do it, but now we are still in this place where on social media, you'll go on, and pretty much most of what you'll see is people trying to make money wrapped in some fakes altruistic
idea. Yeah, you're trying to pick a moment to give you some sort of sheen when actually you're just here to make money.
Yes.
So the Michael, there's two organizers. There's Michael Lang and there's John Scher. Michael Lang was the organizer of the original Woodstock, and he's the one that was kind of moved by Columbine and felt like we needed
another
Woodstock.
Says he was moved by it, says that was the motivation, right?
John Scher was the concert promoter, the guy who is more of a business type and stuff. He's the one that booked the acts because Michael Lang says, yeah, I said I okayed it because I didn't know who any of these acts were. In reality, what I would say is both of this thing was a confluence of old people who didn't know what they were doing, right? Because we got the younger guy, or he was, I can't remember what his name was, but he was one of the people who worked on it, and he said, I remember being in the room and raising my hand, says, you don't want to do this. And everyone kind of looked at him and said, shut up.
Uh-huh. I liked that little aside, but also he raised his hand like 2 days before the event, right?
Sure.
Yep.
And it's like, well, bro, it's done
the
moment, now.
The horse is out of the barn.
Yeah.
So it is, I don't think it was wholly cynical. I think John Scher definitely was like, because they had done it in 94 for the 25th anniversary, and it was a complete wash. Right? They didn't make any money because it was so unorganized and people were getting in for free and stuff. So he Find came at it. So you think about, the weather was bad in 69 as well. So,
yeah.
So you think about what they came to the table with. They came to the table with, hey, this is important. But it's important to a guy who's like 50 something, like you said, Kate, as a high school senior, or for me, early in my college life, it was not a top of mind thing. Like Columbine, like whoa, like oh, these kids, man, whoa, you got to watch out. But it wasn't something like it is now, where we feel like every day it's happening.
Well, but there's something else there too. I mean, worth considering, and that is, throughout the doc, nobody mentioned guns. Nobody mentions anything.
Yeah.
No, none of the acts are like, hey, by the way, everybody, here's why we're here.
No, the acts are there because John Scher said they picked the biggest acts because they wanted to make money. They picked the biggest show.
How can that not be cynical? Of course, it's cynical.
It is. It's absolutely cynical. It's absolutely cynical.
So
yeah, and so you're essentially, to Kate's point as well, you have created an event with no unifying theme. So if you have an event with no unifying theme, why would you think that the event goers would be unified? Everyone's going there for their own reasons, and they are going to reflect the type of bands. If that, you know, if your Woodstock 99 has the bands of the Lilith Fair, it doesn't pop off like that. It's a totally different it's a different environment. And so you create what you've intended to create, even if it was unintentional, like I didn't expect this place to go as wild as it did. You know, I mean, and it's true, Rage Against the Machine is much closer to a Public Enemy than it is a Limp Bizkit, right? That there are specific things about this society that we're telling you, we need you to get involved in and change, not let's just go smash some windows.
Right.
Well, so one of the key things, and listeners will feel this if they watch the doc, that you're processing throughout is you've got the organizers clearly wanting to continue to live by the myth that it was just a handful of people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's the other thing.
The rotten apple, the quote unquote rotten apple theory, and that they never even intimated that any of their decisions along the way to charge $4 for a bottle of water, to have no shade,
to prevent people down and down from bringing in water.
Yeah.
They took no responsibility for that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so the question, like, I think you're left with when you're watching is, where do you assign the blame? Like, are we in a place where, I mean, obviously the answer is nuanced and like there's a lot of blame to go around, but I don't know how much I believe that, like, if you take that same crowd and you put them in a shady hillside, whatever the idyllic vision of Woodstock is when you were growing up and you heard Woodstock and you thought, oh, grass, hills, shade, music.
Mud.
You take that same crowd and you put them, not that Woodstock was that, that just was my impression in my mind. And you put them in a more idyllic setting. Mm. Does this happen?
I think there's a lot of things, right? There's the environment. There is the cleanliness, the sanitation of the environment. There is the price gouging. There is the acts that you booked. Like, these are all things they had control over, right? Now, if you tell me Sheryl Crow gets up there and people start tearing down the sound tower, you win. Maybe it was just 250,000 assholes. But I don't think it was that. And at every festival, there's some awful shit that goes down. At every festival, there are some people who don't mean well. But most festivals, and maybe this is something that they learned after Woodstock 99, given that I'd never been to a festival back then, most of them have repercussions for all of these things. There are safeguards in place. The idea is that it can't just get out of control. I went to the Dreamville Festival in Raleigh, North Carolina, back in April. And it was nothing but, like, orderly and everything that I think these people aspired their festival to be. But there was a shit ton of security. And no, it wasn't volunteers from the local town or whatever, or coming up from
Brooklyn. Well, they said they didn't want to have security carrying weapons.
They got to have, what's the word I'm looking for?
Pepper spray?
Professional security.
Professional security, yeah. These guys weren't professional. You can't have people here. The guy sold his shirt.
Sold his shirt because I got another one. I mean, it was so blatantly disregarding of anything. Everybody was, I don't know if it was naive or just straight up cutting corners, trying to squeeze every last dollar. Because guess what? Security costs money. Manpower costs money, right? Like, all of these things that they needed, that sanitation costs money. And so I don't know whether they were just dumb and they thought, like, everything was going to be cool, or they were just ridiculously, criminally negligently cheap about
it. Well, and also on top of that, to say that part of the sanitation fell apart because the community had chosen privatization. So you had all these independent contractors. I'm like, you didn't know that ahead of time?
Also, what that got to do with your shit, man? Like, that's like, I go to a Miami Heat game down here at FTX Arena, and I was like, oh, it's dirty in here. Damn city of Miami. That ain't the city of Miami. That's the responsibility of the operator of the venue and of the event. You're the operators. You're the ones that's supposed, if you told me there was mountains of trash on the outskirts waiting to get picked up by local municipality, that's fine. But it was literally, the entire tarmac was covered. The security guy said,
expect.
We were walking on top of a layer of trash.
Can we talk about one other quick thing on this too? And that is just MTV in general as well. Because it is interesting too, thinking about the rise. And I don't know, like I said, I'm 53. I don't know if people watch MTV anymore. I never really watched it back then. But there was a time when it was the center of the music culture, right? Mm-hmm. It's huge, hugely important. And, you know, didn't even know. I mean, I think it was like, I moved to San Francisco in 91. And so we were still watching like The Real World and some of those other shows and the rest of it in mid-90s. And then there came a point in time when MTV didn't even show, you know, play music videos anymore. It all switched to M2 and VH1 and the rest of it. And so it was really a really interesting time capsule to go back and see, you know, Kurt Loder and the rest of them all out there.
Serena Altschul and what's my man? Carson Daly.
Yeah, Carson, exactly. And so, you know, when they were talking about how when things started to go sideways, that the crowd had also turned on MTV and they were throwing stuff.
Sure.
I was like, and it made me think of, in some ways, the MAGA rallies where they're attacking the journalists, right? So the messenger is every bit as much part of the corporate machine as the machine itself. You are the machine too. Even though you grew up on that machine, this is where you get your information. This is where you get your music. This is where, you know, you get everything. It was you too, right?
Yeah. I mean, MTV was complicit in terms of, for the people, again, you book these bands that have a very fervent fan base that believes that their music is being glossed over or shoved off in a corner
in favor of NSYNC.
Of NSYNC and Backstreet Boys and Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and all of these acts that came bum, 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 bum. They all blew up right around the same time. And MTV went all chips in the middle of the table on this, right? So what they brought up, Carson Daly, they brought up TRL, right? Which was Total Request Live. This, if you want to talk about the last stand, this might have been the last stand of MTV being in the music business as opposed to reality shows and all the other stuff they've turned ridiculousness all day, every day, forever, right? It was that. It's like I said, it's if the concert, so Kate, earlier you said if this was in an idyllic background, would have been different. I'll give you an example. If the acts were NSYNC, Backstreet Boys, Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, Mandy Moore, do you think we would have seen what happened out there?
Well, there wouldn't have been a documentary.
It would have been a different audience. It would have been a, first and foremost, it would have been a completely different audience, right? An audience that doesn't walk in, perhaps, like, with pent-up anger and aggression and thinking that everything is, quote-unquote, against them or whatever.
Well, you know, you also get something else, too, when you talk about the audience. Mm-hmm. You also get something else with those types of bands. You get parents. Like, because those are pop bands. You get parents. You get, you know, the 15-year-old goes, and their parents go too.
Right.
But this was a college. This was like Daytona times 60,
mm-hmm.
right? Where everybody just goes. And it reminds me too, like I said, I mean, I've said this over again. People who know me know this. I don't want to say I hate people because it sounds so cliche. Mm-hmm. I just avoid them. They just do what they do, and I try to stay away from them. I'm afraid of people. I fear them. I'm totally serious about this because when you put people in a group, shit goes wild, right? That is, the more you put in one small space, the potential for things to go wild gets higher and higher and higher.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I saw, you know, when you do these types of events or anything even close to it, there are certain cities that I don't like, and it's not fair, but it's true. I don't like New Orleans. I don't like Miami. I don't like Las Vegas. And I don't like any of them for the same reason.
Crowds.
And people go there specifically to act like assholes.
Yes. Yes.
They go there for that purpose.
Yes.
To do shit that they
1,000%.
Wouldn't do at home.
And that happened here.
That's what I'm talking about.
That happened here, and that was the thing that also blew my mind, because it's the infancy of this thing that now has become commonplace and widespread throughout our society, which is, if there's a camera rolling, I am going to perform for it.
What would you do for a Klondike bar?
Oh, my God.
That was it. Watching, because one element of the doc was the pay-per-view broadcast.
Yep.
And they weren't really focused on the musicians as much as they were focused on the antics in the crowd and around the quote-unquote campgrounds. And it really was a glimpse into our future.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
In the ways in which, once people saw they were going to be on that, they would just degrade themselves in any manner possible and act the fool to get a clip played on pay-per-view, which is certainly foreshadowing for the future that we now currently live in.
They wanted to go viral, Kate.
That's
the dystopian,
right.
The dystopian future that we live in now. Yes.
Well, and that was the one word that absolutely hit me when I was watching this. And you're looking at this and I'm like, dystopia. Like, yep. this is, and what did one of the guys say? Oh, it's Lord of the Flies, man. Like, they all sort of embraced the, like, all it takes for everything to go off is for one person to rip down the barrier. Right. Yeah. Let's just knock this thing over. And then here we go.
And but I don't know if this is irony or not, but what I kept thinking of watching it was that it's foreshadowing our future. People are behaving in prescient ways to what we now see. But if we had the future then, it would have never happened, because after day, once day two, once the sun rose on day two and people Instagrammed the trash and the feces and the fire fest. It would have sort of stopped its role, because everyone would have known, there would have been media coverage of that. They would have had to fix it in certain ways. So it was like the future, but trapped in a tiny little capsule with no release valve to it.
Right. It's like the Crichton book, The 13th Warrior, right? Or whatever. It was time, whatever.
Cinephobe, podcast where.
Yes. It was a book.
Oh, it was a book. Yeah, I thought 13th Warrior was like an Antonio Banderas. So.
It was, but it was based on a Michael Crichton book.
Got it. Okay, last thing. What I couldn't help thinking from one particular interviewee, it was a young woman who was there, and she got at the festival, she got trench mouth,
which is
because the porta potties were leaking into the water system and the kids were drinking this water thinking it was somewhat clean.
You were drinking feces laced water.
Yes. Oh.
Just to put it out there.
Yes. And trench mouth was, I guess, coined in World War I because this would happen to soldiers. I just want to know, would you ever sit for a documentary 20 years later to let people know that 20 years previously you had trench mouth? It seems like one of those things you still don't want anyone to know. Howard, this is irrelevant for you because this wouldn't have happened to you.
No, it wouldn't happen. But it did remind me of thinking the very same thing a few weeks ago. If you're Fernando Tatis Jr., just say, I use steroids. Don't say you got ringworm. Do you want everyone to know you got ringworm?
Yeah.
Just leave the ringworm out of it. Be like, yeah, I did it. I'm sorry. I apologize to my teammates, to the fans. I let everybody down. But the ringworm part?
All right, everybody, Mother's Day is officially around the corner. If mom's gift isn't already on the way, you've got hours, maybe even minutes, to get it together. So head over to 1-800-Flowers.com right this second. 1-800-Flowers still has great last-minute deals on handmade bouquets, sweet treats, gourmet food, and one-of-a-kind gifts ordered easily and delivered fresh. You want to get mom something that shows your appreciation for all that she's done? We know you've been a knucklehead. She knows you've been a knucklehead. Please do better. Help your mom feel appreciated this Mother's Day. This is your last chance to lock in these Mother's Day deals. Only good while supplies last. Order today at 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan, D-A-N. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/Dan.
Hey, listeners, it's Mike Ryan, and I've changed a lot over the course of 20 years that you've known me. I've gone from unlikable to, well, my hair has changed. But my point is, while a lot's changed over our relationship, there's one thing that hasn't changed one bit, and that's a great taste of Miller Lite. Another thing that hasn't changed is that it's less filling. So what's the best thing about the original light beer? Miller Lite has sparked this debate way back in 1975, and we still haven't settled it. They keep it simple. It's got undebatable quality, great taste, 96 calories, you know all those things. It's a beer that strips everything away that you don't need and holds on to what matters most. But with Miller Lite, you don't have to choose what's best. Miller Lite has great taste and is less filling. It's both those things. Tastes like Miller time. To get Miller Lite delivered right to your door, visit MillerLite.com/Dan, or you can find it pretty much anywhere that sells beer. Celebrate responsibly. Miller Brewing Company, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, 96 calories per 12 ounces. Fewer calories and carbs than premium regular beer.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers. The trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.